Year-old Chestnut, on seeing the dog, started, lifted his tail, and snorted. The other horses, also alarmed, splashed through the water with their hobbled feet, making a sound of slapping as they drew their hoofs out of the thick, clayey mud, and began floundering their way out of the marsh. Laska paused with a mocking look at the horses and a questioning one at Lievin. He stroked her and whistled as a sign that she might now set off. Joyful and preoccupied, Laska started running across the bog, which swayed beneath her feet. On entering the marsh, Laska at once perceived, mingled with the various familiar smells of roots, marsh, grass and rust, and with the unfamiliar smell of horse dung, the scent of the birds, those strong-smelling birds that excited her most, spreading all over the place. Here and there, among the marsh mosses and docks, that smell was very strong, but it was impossible to decide in which direction it grew stronger or weaker. To find this out, it was necessary to go further away in the direction of the wind. Hardly aware of her legs under her, Laska ran at a strained gallop, which she could cut short at a bound should occasion arise, to the right, away from the morning breeze which blew from the east, and then turned to windward. After inhaling the air with distended nostrils, she knew at once that not their scent only, but they themselves were there, before her, not one only, but many of them. She slackened speed. They were there, but she could not yet determine exactly where. To decide this, she began working round in a circle, when her master's voice disturbed her.
"Laska, here,"
he said, pointing to the other side. She stood still, as if asking him whether it would not be better to continue as she had begun. But he repeated his command in a stern voice, pointing to a group of hummocks covered with water where there could not be anything. She obeyed, pretending to search in order to please him, went over the whole place, and then returned to the first spot, and immediately scented them once more. Now that he was not hindering her, she knew what to do, and without looking where she was stepping, stumbling over hummocks and getting into the water, but surmounting the obstacles with her flexible, strong legs, she began the circle which was to make everything clear. Their scent came to her more and more pungently, more and more distinctly, and all at once it became quite clear to her that one of them was here behind a hummock, 5 steps in front. She stopped, and her whole body grew rigid. The shortness of her legs prevented her seeing anything before her, but from the scent she could tell that it was not 5 paces off. She stood, more and more conscious of its presence and enjoying the anticipation. Her rigid tail was outstretched, only its very tip twitching. Her mouth was slightly open and her ears erect. One of her ears had turned back while she ran. She breathed heavily but cautiously, and yet more cautiously looked toward her master, turning her eyes rather than her head. He, with his familiar face but ever terrible eyes, came stumbling over the hummocks, but unusually slowly, she thought. So it seemed to her, though in reality he was running. Noticing Laska's peculiar manner of searching, as lowering her body almost to the ground she appeared to be dragging her broad hind paws, he knew that she was pointing at snipe, and while running up to her he prayed inwardly for success, especially with the first bird. Having come close up to her, he looked beyond, and from his height saw with his eyes what she had found with her nose. In the space between the hummocks, at a distance of about a satsen, he could see a snipe. It sat with turned head, listening. Then, just spreading its wings slightly and folding them again, it vanished round a corner with an awkward, backward jerk.
"Seize it! Seize it!"
shouted Lievin, pushing Laska from behind.
"But I can't go," thought she. "Where should I go to? From here I sent them, but if I go forward I shall not know what I am doing, nor where they are, nor who they are."
But now he pushed her with his knee, saying in an excited whisper,
"Seize it, Laska, seize it!"
"Well, if he wishes it, I will, but I can no longer answer for anything, thought Laska,
and rushed forward at full tilt between the hummocks. She now scented nothing more, but only saw and heard without understanding anything. With lusty cries and a sound of the beating of concave wings so peculiar to the great snipe, a bird rose, and, following the report of the gun, it fell heavily on its white breast 10 paces from the first spot into the wet bog. Another rose behind Lievin without waiting to be disturbed by the dog. By the time Lievin had turned toward it, it had already gone far, but his shot reached it. After flying some 20 feet, the second snipe rose at an acute angle and then, turning round and round like a ball, fell heavily on a dry spot.
Now things will go right, thought Lievin, putting the warm, fat snipe into his bag. Eh, Laska dear, will things go right?
When, having reloaded, Lievin went on again, the sun, though still invisible because of the clouds, had already risen. The moon had lost all her brilliancy and gleamed like a little cloud in the sky. Not a single star was any longer visible. The marsh grass that had glittered like silver in the dew was now golden. The rusty patches were like amber. The bluish grasses had turned yellowish green. Marsh birds were busy in the dew-bespangled bushes that cast long shadows beside the brook. A hawk had woken up and was sitting on a haycock, turning its head from side to side and looking discontentedly at the marsh. Crows were flying to the fields, and a barefooted boy was already driving the horses toward an old man who had got up from beneath his coat and sat scratching himself. The powder smoke spread like milk over the green grass. A boy ran up to Lievin.
"Uncle, there were ducks here yesterday!" he shouted,
following Lievin from afar. And Lievin felt increased pleasure in killing 3 snipe, one after another, within sight of this little boy, who expressed his approval. Chapter 13. The sportsman saying that if you don't miss your first beast or first bird, your day will be successful, was justified. Tired, hungry, and happy, Lievin returned to his lodging toward 10 o'clock, having tramped some 30 versts and bringing 19 red-fleshed birds beside a duck tied to his girdle, as there was no room for it in his bag. His comrades had wakened long before and had had time to get hungry and have their breakfast.
Wait a bit, I know there are 19, said Lievin,
for a second time counting his snipe and great snipe, which no longer had the important appearance they bore when on the wing, but were twisted, dried up, smeared with congealed blood, and had heads bent to one side. The tale was correct, and Oblonsky's envy gratified Lievin. He was also pleased that on his return he found a messenger had already arrived from Kitty with a note.
"I am quite well and happy. If you were uneasy about me, you may be quite at ease now. I have a new bodyguard, Maria Vlasyevna." This was the midwife, a new and important personage in the Lievin's family life. "She has come to see me and finds me perfectly well, and we have got her to stay till your return. All are cheerful and well. So don't hurry, and even stay another day if your sport is good."
These 2 joys, his successful shooting and the news from his wife, were so great that 2 small unpleasantnesses which occurred after the shooting were easy to disregard. One was that the chestnut side horse, having evidently been overworked the previous day, was off its feed and seemed dull. The coachman said it had been strained.
"It was overdriven yesterday, Konstantin Dmitrich," he said. "Why, it was driven hard for 10 versts.
The other unpleasantness, which for a moment upset his good humour, but about which he afterwards laughed heartily, was that of all the provisions that Kitty had provided so lavishly that it had appeared impossible to eat them up in a week, nothing was left. Returning tired and hungry from his sport, Lievin so vividly anticipated the pies that on approaching his lodging he seemed to smell and taste them, just as Laska scented game, and he immediately ordered Philip to serve them. It turned out that there were no pies, nor even any chicken, left.
"He has an appetite," said Oblonsky, laughing and pointing to Vasenka Veslovsky. "I don't suffer from lack of appetite, but he's quite surprising."
"Well, it can't be helped," said Lievin, looking morosely at Veslovsky.
"Well, then, bring me some beef, Philip." "The beef has been eaten, and the bone was given to the dogs," answered Philip.
Lievin was so annoyed that he said crossly, "Something might have been left for me," and he felt inclined to cry.
"Well, then, draw the birds and stuff them with nettles," said he in a trembling voice to Philip, trying not to look at Veslovsky, "and ask at least for some milk for me."
Later on, when he had satisfied his hunger with the milk, he felt ashamed at having shown annoyance to a stranger, and he began laughing at his hungry irritation. In the evening, they again went out shooting, when Veslovsky also killed some birds, and late at night, they set off home. The drive back was as merry as the drive out had been. Veslovsky now sang, now recalled with relish his adventures with the peasants who entertained him with vodka, and said, "No offence," and now his night exploits with hazelnuts, the maidservant, and the peasant who asked him whether he was married, and learning that he was not, said, "Don't hanker after other men's wives, but above all things strive to get one of your own." These words particularly amused Veslovsky.
"Altogether, I'm awfully pleased with our outing. And you, Lievin?"
"I'm very pleased with it, too," said Lievin, sincerely.
He was glad not only to feel no hostility, such as he had felt at home toward Vasenka Veslovsky, but on the contrary, to feel quite friendly toward him.
Chapter 14. Next morning at 10 o'clock, Lievin, having made the round of his farm, knocked at the door of Vasenka's room.
"Entrez!"
shouted Veslovsky.
"Excuse me, I have only just finished my ablutions," he said, smiling, as he stood before Lievin in his underclothes. "Please, don't mind me." And Lievin sat down by the window. "Have you slept well?" "Like the dead. What a day it is for shooting."
"What do you drink? Tea or coffee?"
"Neither. Nothing before lunch. I am really quite ashamed. I expect the ladies are already up. It would be fine to go for a walk now. You must show me your horses."
When they had walked round the garden, visited the stables, and even done some gymnastics together on the parallel bars, Lievin returned to the house with his guest and entered the drawing-room with him.
"We had fine sport and so many new impressions," said Veslovsky, approaching Kitty, who sat at the samovar. "What a pity ladies are deprived of that pleasure."
"Well, what of it? He must say something to the mistress of the house," Lievin told himself. He again thought he noticed something in the smile and conquering air with which the visitor addressed Kitty. The princess, who sat at the other end of the table with Maria Vlasyevna and Oblonsky, called Lievin and began a conversation about moving to Moscow for Kitty's confinement and taking a house there. Just as all the preparations for the wedding had been disagreeable to him, since they detracted by their insignificance from the majesty of what was taking place, so now the preparations for the coming birth, the time of which they were reckoning on their fingers, appeared to him yet more offensive. He always tried not to hear those conversations about the best way of swaddling the future infant, tried to turn away and not see those mysterious, endless knitted binders and three-cornered pieces of linen to which Dolly attached special importance, and all the rest. The birth of a son, he was certain it would be a son, which they promised him, but in which he still could not believe, so extraordinary did it seem, appeared to him on the one hand such an immense and therefore impossible happiness, and on the other such a mysterious event, that this pretended knowledge of what was going to happen and consequent preparations as for something ordinary, something produced by human beings, seemed to him an indignity and a degradation. But the princess did not understand his feelings and attributed his unwillingness to think and speak about it to thoughtlessness and indifference, and therefore gave him no peace. She was now commissioning Oblonsky to see about a house and called Glievin to her.
"I don't know at all, princess. Do as you think best," he said.
"You must decide when you will move."
"I really don't know. I know that millions of children are born without Moscow and without doctors. Then why—"
"Well, if that's—"
"Oh, no, just as Kitty likes."
"But one can't talk to Kitty about it. Why, do you want me to frighten her? You know, only this spring, Natalie Golitsyn died because she had a bad doctor."
"I will do whatever you tell me to," he replied morosely. The princess began telling him, but he did not listen to her. Though this talk with the princess upset him, it was not that, but what he saw by the samovar, which made him morose.
"No, this is impossible," he thought,
glancing occasionally at Vasenka, who was leaning toward Kitty and saying something with his handsome smile, and at Kitty, blushing and agitated. There was something impure in Vasenka's attitude, his look, and his smile. Lievin even saw something impure in Kitty's pose and smile. And again the light faded from his eyes. Again, as on the previous occasion, he suddenly, without the least interval, felt thrown from the height of happiness, peace, and dignity into an abyss of despair, malevolence, and degradation. Again, everyone and everything became revolting to him.
"Well then, princess, let it be just as you think best," he said, turning away.
"Heavy is the autocrat's crown," said Oblonsky, banteringly, evidently alluding not only to the princess's conversation, but also to the cause of Lievin's agitation, which he had observed.
"How late you are today, Dolly!"
They all rose to greet Dolly. Vasenka only rose for a moment, and with the absence of politeness to women which is characteristic of modern young men, barely bowed, and again continued his conversation, laughing at something.
"Masha has worn me out. She slept badly, and is terribly capricious this morning," said Dolly.
The conversation with Kitty, begun by Vasenka, again dealt with Anna, and with the question whether love can rise above social conditions. This conversation was unpleasant to Kitty and upset her, both by the subject itself and by the tone in which it was carried on, but especially because she already knew the effect it would have on her husband. But she was too simple and innocent to know how to stop it, or even how to conceal the superficial pleasure which this young man's evident attentions caused her. She wished to put an end to the conversation, but did not know how. Whatever she did, she knew would be noticed by her husband and would all be construed into something wrong. And really, when she asked Dolly what was the matter with Masha, and Vasenka, waiting for this uninteresting conversation to finish, gazed indifferently at Dolly, her question seemed to Lievin a piece of unnatural and disgusting cunning.
"Well, shall we go to pick mushrooms today?" said Dolly.
"Yes, please, and I will go too," said Kitty, and blushed. She had been going out of politeness to ask Vasenka whether he would go with them, but refrained.
"Where are you going, Kostya?"
she asked her husband with a guilty look as he passed by with resolute steps. This guilty look confirmed all his suspicions.
"The mechanic arrived during my absence, and I've not yet seen him," he answered, without looking at her.
He went downstairs, but had not had time to leave his study before he heard his wife's familiar footsteps following him with imprudent rapidity.
"What is it?" he asked dryly. "We're busy."
"Excuse me," she said, addressing the German mechanic. "I have a few words to say to my husband." The German was about to go out, but Lievin said to him,
"Don't trouble." "The train is at 3? Asked the German. "I must not miss it."
Lievin did not answer him, but went out with his wife.
"Well, what have you to say to me?"
he asked in French. He did not look her in the face, and did not notice that she, in her condition, stood with her whole face twitching, and had a pitiful, crushed appearance.
I want to tell you that it's impossible to live like this. It's torture, she muttered.
The servants are there, in the pantry, he said angrily. Don't make a scene.
Well then, come here.
They were in a passage, and Kitty wished to enter the next room. But the English governess was there, giving Tanya a lesson.
Well, come into the garden.
In the garden they came upon a man weeding a path, and without any longer considering that the man saw her tear-stained eyes and his excited face, or that they looked like people running away from some calamity, they went on with rapid feet, feeling that they must speak out and convince each other, must be alone together, and thereby both escape from the torment both were experiencing.
One can't live like this. It is torture. I suffer and you suffer. Why?
She asked, when they had at last reached a secluded seat at the corner of the Lime Tree Avenue. Only tell me this. Was there something improper, impure, degradingly horrid in his tone? He said, standing in front of her in the same attitude as on that night, with fists pressing his chest.
There was, she said in a trembling voice. But, Kostya, do you really not see that I am not to blame? From the time I came down, I wanted to adopt a tone. But these people, why did he come? How happy we were,
she said, choking with sobs that shook the whole of her expanded body. The gardener saw with surprise that, though nothing had been pursuing them, and there had been nothing to run away from, and they could not have found anything very blissful on that seat, they passed him on their way back to the house with quieted and beaming faces. Chapter 15. After seeing his wife upstairs, Lievin went to Dolly's part of the house. She, too, was in great trouble that day. She was walking up and down the room and speaking angrily to a little girl who stood howling in a corner.
You'll stand in that corner all day, and we'll have your dinner alone, and you will not see a single doll, and I won't have a new frock made for you, she was saying, unable to think of any more punishments for the child. Ooh, she is a horrid child, she cried, addressing Lievin. Where do these vile tendencies in her come from?
But what has she done? Asked Lievin, rather indifferently. He wanted to consult her about his own affairs, and was annoyed at having come at an inopportune moment.
She and Grisha went away among the raspberry canes, and there, I can't even tell what she did. One regrets Miss Elliot 1,000 times. This one does not look after the children. She's only a machine. Figurez-vous que la petite...
Dolly told Masha's crime. That proves nothing. It is not a bad tendency, but just mischievousness, Lievin comforted her. But you are upset about something. Why have you come? Asked Dolly. What's happening there? And by the tone of her question, Lievin knew that it would be easy for him to tell her what he meant to say. I was not there, but have been in the garden alone with Kitty. We have quarrelled for the second time since Stever's arrival. Dolly gazed at him with wise, comprehending eyes.
Well, tell me, hand on heart, was there, not on Kitty's side, but on that gentleman's, a tone which might be unpleasant, not unpleasant, but terrible and offensive to a husband? That is to say, how am I to put it?
Stop! Stop in the corner, she said, turning to Masha,
who, noticing a scarcely perceptible smile on her mother's face, was turning round.
The world would say he has behaved as all young men behave,
Il fait la cour à une jeune et jolie femme, and a society husband should be merely flattered by it.
Yes, yes, answered Lievin gloomily. But you noticed it?
Not I only, but Stiva too. He told me frankly after tea, je crois que Veslovsky fait un petit brin de cour à Kitty.
Well, all right. Now I am tranquil. I will turn him out, said Lievin.
What do you mean? Have you gone mad? Exclaimed Dolly, terrified. What do you mean, Kostya? Oh, consider, she went on, laughing.
You can go to Fanny now, she said to Masha. No. If you like, I will tell Stiva, and he will take him away. One can say you were expecting visitors.
Certainly he does not suit your household. No, no. I'll do it myself.
But you will quarrel?
Not at all.
It will be a pleasure for me.
A real pleasure, said Lievin, with sparkling eyes.
Come, forgive her, Dolly. She won't do it again, he pleaded, referring to the small culprit, who had not gone to Fanny, but stood hesitatingly before her mother, looking up from under her brows, expecting and trying to catch her eye. Dolly looked at her. The little girl burst into sobs and buried her face in her mother's lap, and Dolly placed her thin, tender hand on the child's head.
What is there in common between us and him? Thought Lievin, as he went in search of Veslovsky.
Passing through the hall, he ordered the calèche to be harnessed to drive to the station.
One of the springs broke yesterday, replied the footman. Well, then, the tarantass, but make haste. Where is the visitor? He's gone to his room.
Lievin found Vasenka, who had unpacked his portmanteau and spread out his new songs, trying on a pair of leggings and preparing for a ride. Whether there was something unusual in Lievin's face, or whether Vasenka himself felt that le petit brin de cour which he had started was out of place in this family, he was embarrassed, as far as is permissible to a man in society, by Lievin's entry.
You wear leggings for riding?
Yes, it's much cleaner, said Vasenka,
placing his fat foot on a chair, fastening the bottom hook, and smiling good-naturedly. He was, certainly, a good-natured fellow, and Lievin felt sorry for him, and ashamed of himself as a host, when he noticed the shyness of Vasenka's look. On the table lay a piece of stick, which, when doing gymnastics that morning, they had broken, trying to raise the warped parallel bars. Lievin took the broken stick and began pulling off the splintered bits at the end, not knowing how to begin.
I wished...
He stopped. But suddenly remembering Kitty and all that had happened, he said, looking Veslovsky firmly in the eyes,
I have ordered the horses to be harnessed for you.
What do you mean?
Vasenka began with surprise.
To drive where?
For you. To the station,
answered Lievin gloomily, pulling off splinters.
Why? Are you going away, or has anything happened?
It happens that I'm expecting visitors, replied Lievin more rapidly, breaking off the splintered bits of the stick with his strong fingers. Or, no, I am not expecting visitors, and nothing has happened. Yet I request you to leave. You may explain my impoliteness as you please.
Vasenka drew himself up.
I ask you for an explanation, he said with dignity, having at last understood.
I can't give you an explanation, said Lievin, softly and slowly, trying to control the trembling of his jaw. And it is better for you not to ask. As the splinters were now all broken off, Lievin grasped the thick ends in his fingers and split the stick, carefully catching a piece as it fell. Probably the sight of those strained arms, those muscles he had felt that morning when doing gymnastics, and the gleaming eyes, low voice, and trembling jaws convinced Vasenka more than the words. He shrugged his shoulders, smiled contemptuously, and bowed.
Can I not see Oblonsky? The shrug and smile did not irritate Lievin. What else is there for him to do, he thought. I will send him to you at once.
What is this nonsense?
Said Oblonsky, when he had heard from his friend that he was being driven out of the house, and had found Lievin in the garden, where he was walking while awaiting the departure of his visitor.
Mais c'est ridicule! What fly has stung you? Mais c'est du dernier ridicule! Why, do you imagine that if a young man...
But the place where the fly had stung Lievin was evidently still sore, for he again grew pale when Oblonsky wished to refer to his reason and hastily interrupted him.
Please, don't explain my reasons. I can't do otherwise. I feel ashamed before you and before him, but I don't think it will grieve him much to go away, and his presence is unpleasant to me and to my wife.
But he feels insulted. Et puis, c'est ridicule.
And I feel insulted and tortured, and I have done nothing wrong and don't deserve to suffer.
Well, I never expected this of you.
On peut être jaloux, mais à ce point, c'est du dernier ridicule.
Lievin turned away from him quickly, and went far down one of the avenues where he continued walking up and down alone. Soon he heard the rattle of the tarantass, and through the trees saw Vasenka seated on hay. Unluckily, the tarantass had no seat, with the Scotch bonnet on his head, jolting over the ruts as he was driven down the other avenue.
"What does that mean?"
wondered Lievin, when the footman ran out of the house and stopped the vehicle. It was on account of the mechanic, whom Lievin had quite forgotten. He bowed and said something to Veslovsky, then climbed into the tarantass, and they drove away together. Oblonsky and the princess were indignant at Lievin's conduct. He himself felt not only that he was in the highest degree ridiculous, but quite guilty and disgraced. But recalling what he and his wife had suffered, and asking himself how he would act another time, he answered that he would do just the same again. In spite of all this, by the end of the day, everyone except the princess, who could not forgive Lievin's conduct, became unusually animated and merry, like children after a punishment, or adults after an oppressive official reception, so that in the princess's absence they talked about Vasenka's expulsion as of an historic event. Dolly, who had inherited her father's gift of putting things humorously, made Varenka collapse with laughter when she related for the third or fourth time, with ever fresh humorous additions, how she was just putting on some new ribbons in the visitor's honour and was about to go into the drawing-room when suddenly she heard the clatter of the old cart. And who was inside the cart? Who but Vasenka, with his Scotch bonnet and his songs and his leggings, sitting on the hay? At least you might have let him have the brougham. And then I hear, "Stop!" Well, think I, they've relented. I look again, and they had popped a fat German in with him and were driving them both off. And so my ribbons were all in vain. Chapter 16. Dolly carried out her intention of going to see Anna. She was very sorry to grieve her sister and to do anything that was unpleasant to Lievin. She felt that they were right in not wishing to have anything to do with Vronsky, but felt it her duty to visit Anna and show her that the altered circumstances could not change her own feelings toward her. Not to depend on the Lievins for that journey, Dolly sent to the village to hire horses, but Lievin, hearing of it, came and reproached her.
Why do you think your going would be unpleasant to me?
Even if it were unpleasant, it would be still more unpleasant for me if you did not use my horses, he said.
You never told me definitely that you were going.
And that you should hire horses in the village is, in the first place, unpleasant to me, and besides that, they will undertake the job but won't get you there.
I have horses, and if you don't wish to grieve me, you will take them.
Dolly had to agree, and on the appointed day, Lievin had four horses ready for his sister-in-law, as well as a relay, having made it up of farm and riding horses, not at all a handsome team, but one able to get her to her destination in a day. As horses were also required for the princess who was leaving, and for the midwife, It was inconvenient to Levin, but he could not be so inhospitable as to allow Dolly to hire horses while staying with him. Besides, he knew that the 20 rubles she would have had to pay for the journey were of importance to her, and he felt her distressing financial embarrassments as if they had been his own. Acting on Levin's advice, Dolly started before daybreak. The road was good, the calèche comfortable, the horses ran merrily, and on the box beside the coachman, instead of a footman, sat an office clerk whom Levin sent with her for safety. Dolly dozed, and only woke up when approaching the inn where the horses were to be changed. After drinking tea at the prosperous peasant's house where Levin had stopped when on his way to Sviatsky's, and conversing with the women about their children, and with the old man about Count Vronsky, of whom he spoke very highly, Dolly continued her journey at 10 o'clock. At home, her care of the children never gave her leisure to think. But now, during this 4 hours' drive, all the thoughts she had repressed crowded suddenly into her mind, and she reviewed her whole life from all sides as she had never done before. Her thoughts seemed strange to her. At first she thought of the children, about whom, though the princess, and especially Kitty, she had greater faith in Kitty, had promised to look after them, she still felt anxious. If only Masha does not get into mischief again, or a horse does not kick Grisha, and if only Lily's digestion does not get more upset. But then questions of the present began to be replaced by those of the immediate future. She began thinking that she would have to move into another house in Moscow for the winter, have the drawing-room furniture recovered, and a new winter coat made for the eldest girl. Then came problems of a more remote future. How she should start her children in the world. With the girls it would be comparatively easy, she thought. How about the boys? At present I am teaching Grisha, but that is only because I am free now and not having a baby. Of course, Stiva is not to be counted on, but with the help of kind people I shall start them somehow. But in case of another child... And it occurred to her how inaccurate it is to say that woman's curse is the bringing forth of children. Travail, that's nothing, but pregnancy is torture, she thought, with her last pregnancy and the death of her infant in mind. And she recalled a talk she had had with a young woman at the halting place. In answer to the question whether she had any children, the good-looking young peasant wife had cheerfully replied, "I had one girl, but God released me. I buried her in Lent." "And are you very sorry?" asked Dolly. "What's there to be sorry about? The old man has plenty of grandchildren as it is. They're nothing but worry. You can't work or anything. They're nothing but a tie." This answer had seemed horrible to Dolly, despite the good-natured sweetness of the young woman's looks. But now she could not help recalling it. In those cynical words, there was some truth. Altogether, she thought, looking back at the whole of her life during those 15 years of wedlock, pregnancy, sickness, dullness of mind, indifference to everything, and above all, disfigurement. Even Kitty, young, pretty Kitty, how much plainer she has become. And I, when I am pregnant, become hideous, I know. Travail, suffering, monstrous suffering, and that final moment. Then nursing, sleepless nights, and that awful pain. Dolly shuddered at the mere thought of the pain she had endured from sore nipples, from which she had suffered with almost every baby. Then the children's illnesses, that continued anxiety, and their education, nasty tendencies. She recalled little Masha's delinquency among the raspberry canes. Lessons, Latin. It is all so incomprehensible and difficult. And above all, the death of these children. And once more the cruel memory rose that always weighed on her mother heart, the death of her last baby. a boy who died of croup. His funeral, the general indifference shown to the little pink coffin, and her own heart-rending, lonely grief at the sight of that pale little forehead with the curly locks on the temples, and of the open, surprised little mouth visible in the coffin at the instant before they covered it, with the pink lid ornamented with a gold lace cross. But what is it all for? What will come of it all? I myself, without having a moment's peace, now pregnant, now nursing, always cross and grumbling, tormenting myself and others, repulsive to my husband, I shall live my life and produce unfortunate, badly brought up, and beggared children. Even now, if we had not spent this summer with Kostya and Kitty, I don't know how we should have managed. Of course, Kostya and Kitty are so considerate that we don't feel it. But it can't go on so. They will have children of their own and won't be able to help us. As it is, they are put to inconvenience. There's Papa, who has kept scarcely anything for himself, to help us. So I can't even give the children a start myself, unless it's with other people's help and with humiliation. Well, supposing the best, that none of the other children die, and that I somehow succeed in bringing them up, at the very best they will only escape being ne'er-do-wells. That is all I can hope for. And for this, so much suffering and trouble. My whole life ruined. Again she remembered what the young woman had said. Again the recollection was repulsive to her, but she could not help admitting that there was a measure of crude truth in the words. "Is it much further, Mikhail?" she asked the clerk, to dispel the thoughts that frightened her. "They say it's 7 versts from this village." The caleche was descending the village street to a small bridge. A crowd of merry peasant women, with ready-twisted sheaf-binders hanging from their shoulders, were crossing the bridge, chattering loudly and merrily. The women stopped on the bridge, inquisitively scrutinizing the caleche. All the faces turned toward her seemed to Dolly to be healthy and bright, mocking her with their joy in life.
"Everybody lives. Everybody enjoys living,"
Dolly continued her reflections when, after passing the peasant women and having reached the top of the incline, they were going at a trot, the old caleche comfortably swaying on its soft springs. "And I, released as from a prison, from the world that is killing me with its worries, have only now collected my thoughts for a moment. Everybody lives. These women, and my sister Natalie, and Varenka, and Anna, to whom I am going. Only not I. And they are all down on Anna. What for? Am I better than she? I at least have a husband whom I love. Not as I wish to love, but still I do love him. But Anna did not love hers. In what is she to blame? She wishes to live. God has implanted that need in our souls. It is quite possible I might have done the same. I don't even know whether I did well to listen to her that terrible time when she came to me in Moscow. I ought then to have left my husband and begun life anew. I might have loved and been loved the real way. But is it better now? I don't respect him. I need him. She thought of her husband. And I put up with him. Is that any better? I was still attractive then, still had my good looks, she went on, feeling that she wanted to see herself in a glass. She had a small travelling looking-glass in her bag and felt inclined to take it out. But glancing at the backs of the coachman and the clerk who sat swaying beside him, She knew she would feel ashamed if one of them chanced to look round, and she did not take it out. Yet even without looking in the glass, she thought it might not be too late, even now. She remembered Koznishev, who was particularly amiable to her. Stiva's friend, the good-natured Turovtsin, who had helped her nurse her children when they had scarlet fever, and who was in love with her. And then there was a very young man who considered, so her husband told her as a joke, that she was the handsomest of the three sisters, and the most passionate and impossible romances occurred to Dolly's fancy. Anna has acted excellently, and I, at any rate, shall not reproach her at all. She is happy, she is making another happy, and is not dragged down as I am. But she is no doubt as fresh, clever, and frank as ever, she thought. And a roguish smile puckered her lips, chiefly because while thinking of Anna's romance, she invented an almost similar romance for herself with an imaginary, collective man who was in love with her. Like Anna, she confessed everything to her husband, and Oblonsky's surprise and embarrassment at the announcement made her smile. Wrapped in such dreams, she reached the turning from the high road, which led to Vozvizhenskoy. Chapter 17. The coachman stopped the horses and looked round toward a field of rye on the right, where some peasants sat beside a cart. The clerk wished to get down, but then, changing his mind, shouted authoritatively and beckoned to a peasant. The breeze which they had felt while driving died down when they stopped, and horseflies settled on the sweating horses, which angrily tried to brush them off. The metallic sound of a scythe being hammered beside the cart ceased, and one of the peasants rose and came toward the calèche.
"Look at him! Stuck fast!"
shouted the clerk angrily at the peasant, who was slowly stepping with bare feet over the ruts of the dry, hard-trodden road.
"Be quick!"
The curly-headed old man, with a piece of bast tied round his head, his rounded back, dark with perspiration, increased his speed approaching the calèche and put his sunburnt arm on the mudguard.
"Vozvizhenskoy? The squire's house? To the count's?" he repeated. "There. When you have passed that bend, turn to the left and go right down the drive, and you'll knock up straight against it. But whom do you want? The squire?"
"Are they at home, my good man?" said Dolly, vaguely, not knowing how to speak of Anna, even to a peasant.
"I expect so,"
said the peasant, shifting from one bare foot to the other, leaving in the dust a clear imprint of it with its five toes.
"I expect so,"
he repeated, evidently desiring a talk.
"More visitors arrived yesterday."
"Visitors?
Just awful. What do you want?"
He turned toward a lad beside the cart who was shouting something.
"Quite right. A while ago they passed by here on horseback to see the reaper. Now they must be at home again. And who may you be?"
"We have come a long way," replied the coachman, climbing back onto the box. "And you say it's not far?"
"I tell you, it's just there, where you come out."
And he went on rubbing his hand along the mudguard of the calèche. A young, healthy-looking, thick-set lad also came up.
"Could I get a job harvesting?" he asked.
"I don't know, my lad. There, you see, when you've turned to the left, you'll knock straight up against it,"
said the peasant, evidently unwilling to let them go and wishing to talk. The coachman started, but hardly had they gone round the corner when the peasants called out to them.
"Stop, friend! Stop!"
shouted two voices. The coachman pulled up.
"They're coming! Here they are, themselves!"
cried the man, pointing to four persons on horseback and two in a charabanc coming along the road. It was Vronsky with his jockey, Veslovsky and Anna on horseback, and Princess Barbara with Sviatsky in the charabanc. They had been for a ride, and to see some newly arrived reaping machines in operation. When the calèche pulled up, the riders advanced at a foot pace. Anna rode in front beside Veslovsky. She rode quietly on a small, sturdy English cob with a close-cropped mane and short tail. Dolly was struck by the beauty of her head, with locks of black hair which had escaped under her top hat, her full shoulders and fine waist in the black riding habit, and her whole quiet, graceful bearing. For a moment she thought it improper for Anna to be riding on horseback. In Dolly's mind, the idea of horse riding for women was connected with youthful coquetry, which, in her opinion, was unsuitable to a woman in Anna's position. But when she saw her closer, she at once became reconciled to Anna's riding. Despite her elegance, everything about Anna, her bearing, clothes, and movements, was so simple, quiet, and dignified that nothing could seem more natural. At Anna's side, on a heated bay cavalry horse, stretching out his fat legs and evidently admiring himself, rode Vasenka Veslovsky, wearing the Scotch bonnet with waving ribbons, and Dolly could not repress a merry smile on recognizing him. Behind them rode Vronsky. He was on a thoroughbred dark bay, which was obviously heated by galloping, and he was using the reins to hold it in. Behind him rode a short man dressed as a jockey. Sviatsky and the Princess Barbara, in a new charabanc to which was harnessed a tall trotter, were overtaking the riders. Anna's face immediately brightened into a joyful smile when she recognized Dolly and the little figure pressed back in a corner of the old calèche. She gave an exclamation, started in her saddle, and touched her horse into a gallop. Riding up to the calèche, she jumped unaided from the horse and, holding up her habit, ran toward Dolly.
"It's what I thought, but dared not expect. What a pleasure! You cannot imagine how delighted I am!"
she cried, now pressing her face to Dolly's and kissing her, now leaning back to gaze smilingly at her.
"What joy, Alexei!"
she said, turning to Vronsky, who had dismounted and was walking toward them. Vronsky, taking off his grey top hat, approached Dolly.
"You can have no idea how pleased we are that you have come," he said, putting peculiar emphasis into his words, while a smile exposed his strong white teeth.
Vasenka Veslovsky, without dismounting, raised his cap and welcomed the visitor, joyously waving his ribbons above his head. "That is the Princess Barbara," Anna said, in answer to Dolly's glance of inquiry when the charabanc came nearer.
"Oh,"
said Dolly, and her face involuntarily expressed displeasure. The Princess Barbara was her husband's aunt. She had long known her and did not respect her. She knew that the Princess Barbara had all her life been a hanger-on to various rich relatives, but that she, a relation of Dolly's husband, should now be living in the house of Vronsky, a perfect stranger to her, offended Dolly. Anna noticed Dolly's expression, became confused, blushed, let her habit slip out of her hands and stumbled over it. Dolly walked up to the charabanc and coldly greeted Princess Barbara. She was acquainted with Sviatsky, too. He asked how his friend the crank was getting on with his young wife, and having glanced at the ill-matched horses and the patched mudguard of the calèche, offered the ladies seats in the charabanc.
"I will go in that vehicle," he said. "My horse is a quiet one, and the princess drives splendidly."
"No, stay as you are," said Anna, who had also come up, "and we too will go in the calèche."
And giving Dolly her arm, she led her away. Dolly was dazzled by the elegant equipage of a kind she had never seen, by the beautiful horses and the elegant, brilliant persons about her. But what struck her most was the change that had taken place in Anna, whom she knew and loved. Another woman, less observant, who had not known Anna before, especially one who had not thought the thoughts that were in Dolly's mind on the way, would not have noticed anything peculiar in Anna. But now Dolly was struck by that temporary beauty which only comes to women in moments of love, and which she now found in Anna's face. Everything in that face, the definiteness of the dimples on cheeks and chin, the curve of her lips, the smile that seemed to flutter around her face, the light in her eyes, the grace and swiftness of her movements, the fullness of her voice, even the manner in which she replied, half crossly, half kindly, to Veslovsky, who asked permission to ride her cob that he might teach it to lead with the right leg when galloping. Everything about her was peculiarly attractive, and she seemed to know it and to be glad of it. When the two women took their seats in the calèche, both were seized with shyness. Anna was abashed by the attentively inquiring look Dolly bent upon her. Dolly, after Sviatsky's remark about the vehicle, felt involuntarily ashamed of the ramshackle old calèche in which Anna had taken a seat beside her. Philip, the coachman, and the clerk shared that feeling. The clerk, to hide his embarrassment, bustled about, helping the ladies in, but Philip became morose and made up his mind not to be imposed upon by this external superiority. He smiled ironically as he glanced at the raven trotter of the Charabanc, deciding that that horse was good for nothing but a promenade and could not do its 40 versts on a hot day at one go. The peasants beside the cart all got up and looked with merry curiosity at the visitor, making their own comments.
"Glad they are. I've not met for a long time," said the curly-haired old man with a piece of bast tied round his head. "There now, Uncle Gerasim. That raven gelding would cart the sheaves in no time."
"Just look. Is that a woman in breeches?"
cried one, pointing to Vasenka Veslovsky, who was getting into the side saddle.
"No, it's a man. See how easily he jumped up?" "I say, lads, it seems we are not to have a sleep."
"What chance of a sleep today?" said the old man, blinking at the sun.
"It's too late. Take your scythes, and let's get to work."
Chapter 18. Anna was looking at Dolly's thin, wan face with its dust-filled wrinkles and wishing to tell her just what she thought. The Dolly looked thinner and worse. But remembering that her own looks had improved and that Dolly's eyes had told her so, she sighed and began talking about herself. "You are looking at me," she said, "and wondering whether I can be happy, placed as I am. Well, what do you think? I am ashamed to confess it, but I am unforgivably happy. Something magical has happened to me. Like a dream when one feels frightened and creepy and suddenly wakes up to the knowledge that no such terrors exist. I have wakened up. I have lived through sufferings and terrors, but for a long time past, especially since we came here, I have been happy," she said, looking at Dolly timidly and with a questioning smile. "I am so glad," answered Dolly, smiling, but in a colder tone than she intended. "I am very glad for your sake. Why did you not write to me?" "Why?" "Because I did not dare. You forget my position."
"To me? You dared not? If only you knew how I consider—"
Dolly wanted to tell Anna what she had been thinking that morning, but for some reason it now seemed out of place. "However, we will talk about all that later. What is this? What are all those buildings?" "Quite a town," she asked, to change the subject, pointing to the red and green roofs visible above a living green wall of acacias and lilacs. But Anna did not answer her. "No, no. What view do you take of my position? What do you think?"
"What?"
she asked. "I imagine," Dolly began. But at that moment Vasenka Veslovsky, who had got the cob to lead with the right foot, galloped past in his short jacket, bumping heavily on the leathers of the side saddle.
"It goes all right, Anna Arkadyevna," he shouted.
Anna did not even glance at him, but it still seemed to Dolly out of place to begin to discuss this big subject in the calèche, so she briefly replied, "I don't take any view. I always loved you, and if one loves, one loves the whole person as he or she is, and not as one might wish them to be." Anna, turning her eyes away from her friend and screwing them up, this was a new habit of hers and unfamiliar to Dolly, grew thoughtful, trying thoroughly to grasp the meaning of the remark. Having evidently understood it in the sense she wished, she glanced at Dolly. "If you had any sins," she said, "they would all be forgiven you for coming here and for those words." And Dolly noticed that tears had started to her eyes. She silently pressed Anna's hand. "But what are those buildings? What a lot of them there are," said she after a moment's silence, repeating her question. "They are the employees' houses, the stud farm, and the stables," answered Anna. "And here the park begins. Everything had been neglected, but Alexei has had it all renovated. He's very fond of this estate, and, a thing I never expected of him, he's quite enthusiastic in managing the place. But of course his is such a talented nature. Whatever he takes up, he does splendidly. He's not only not bored, but passionately engrossed in his occupations. He has grown into a first-rate, prudent landlord, as I recognize. In farming matters, he is even stingy, but only in farming. Where it is a question of thousands, he does not count them," she said, with that joyous, sly smile with which women often speak of the secret characteristics discovered by them alone of the man they love. "Do you see that big building? It is the new hospital. I think it will cost more than 100,000 rubles. That is his hobby just now. And you know why he started it? The peasants asked him to let them some meadows at a reduced rent, I think, and he refused, and I reproached him with being stingy. Of course, it was not that alone, but one thing with another caused him to start that hospital to show, you know, that he is not stingy. C'est une petitesse, if you like, but I love him the better for it. And now you will see the house in a moment. It was his grandfather's, and it has not been altered at all on the outside." "How fine," said Dolly, looking with involuntary surprise at a handsome house with a row of columns standing out among the variously tinted foliage of the old trees in the garden. "It is fine, is it not? And from upstairs the view is wonderful." They drove into a gravelled courtyard surrounded by flowers, where two men were making a border of rough, porous stones round a well-forked flowerbed, and stopped beneath a roofed portico. "Ah, they've already arrived," said Anna, looking at the horses that were being led away from the front door. "Don't you think that one is a beautiful horse? It is a cob, my favourite. Bring it here and get me some sugar." "Where is the Count?" she asked the two elegant footmen who had rushed out. "Ah, there he is," she went on, seeing Vronsky and Veslovsky coming out to meet her.
"In which room are you putting the princess?" Vronsky asked in French, addressing Anna, and without waiting for her answer, he once more welcomed Dolly, and this time he kissed her hand.
"The large room with the balcony, I should think."
"Oh, no, that's too far off. The corner room will be better. We shall see more of one another there." "Well, let's go in," said Anna, who had given her favourite horse the sugar the footman had brought. "Et vous oubliez votre devoir," said she to Veslovsky, who was also standing in the portico.
"Pardon, j'en ai tout plein les poches,"
he answered with a smile, plunging his fingers into his waistcoat pocket. "Mais vous venez trop tard," she said, wiping with her handkerchief the hand which the horse had wetted as it took the sugar. Anna turned to Dolly. "How long can you stay?"
"Only a day? That's impossible."
"I have promised, and the children," answered Dolly, feeling embarrassed because she had to get her bag out of the calèche and because she knew her face was covered with dust.
"No, Dolly, darling. Well, we will see. Come, come along."
And Anna led the way to Dolly's room. It was not the grand room that Vronsky had suggested, but one for which Anna apologized to Dolly. And this room needing an apology was full of luxuries, such as Dolly had never lived among, which reminded her of the best hotels abroad. "Well, dearest, how happy I am," said Anna, who in her riding habit had sat down for a moment beside Dolly.
"Tell me about yourselves. I meet Steva in passing, but he can't tell me about the children. How is my pet, Tanya? Grown a big girl, I suppose."
"Yes, quite big," answered Dolly shortly, and was herself surprised that she could talk so coldly about her children. "We are very comfortable at the Levins," she added.
"There now. Had I only known that you don't despise me," said Anna, "you should all have come to us. You know Steva and Alexei are old and great friends," she added, and suddenly blushed.
"Yes, but we are so comfortable," answered Dolly with embarrassment.
"However, my joy makes me talk nonsense. But really, dear, I am so glad to see you," said Anna, kissing her again. "You have not yet told me how and what you think about me, and I want to know everything. But I'm glad that you will see me just as I am. Above all, I don't want you to think that I wish to prove anything. I don't want to prove anything. Simply, I wish to live, not hurting anyone but myself. I have a right to do that, have I not?
However, that needs a long talk, and we will talk it all well over later.
Now, I will go and dress and send you the maid."
Chapter 19. Left alone, Dolly surveyed the room with a housewife's eye. All she saw when driving up to the house and passing through it, and now in her room, gave her the impression of abundance and elegance, and of that novel European luxury which she had read about in English novels, but had never yet seen in Russia, in the country. Everything was new, from the new French wallpapers to the carpet which covered the whole floor. The bed had a spring and an overlay mattress, with a specially shaped bolster and small pillows with silk slips. The marble washstand, the dressing table, the couch, the tables, the bronze clock on the mantelpiece, the curtains and door hangings were all costly and new. The smart lady's maid, with hair stylishly done and wearing a dress more fashionable than Dolly's, who came to offer her services, was as new and expensive as everything else in the room. Dolly found her politeness, tidiness, and attention pleasant, but did not feel at ease with her. She was ashamed to let her see the patched dressing jacket, which, as ill luck would have it, she had brought by mistake. She was ashamed of the very patches and darns on which she at home prided herself. At home, it was clear that 6 jackets required 24 arshins of nansuk at 65 kopecks, which comes to no more than 15 rubles, besides the trimmings and the work, and she had saved all that. But before the maid, she felt not exactly ashamed, but uncomfortable. Dolly felt much relieved when Anushka, whom she had known a long time, came into the room. The smart maid had to go to her mistress, and Anushka remained with Dolly. Anushka was evidently very pleased that the lady had come, and chattered incessantly. Dolly noticed that she wanted to express her opinion of her mistress's position, and especially of the Count's love of and devotion to Anna. But Dolly carefully stopped her whenever she began to speak about that subject.
"I grew up with Anna Arkadyevna. She is dearer to me than anything. Is it for us to judge? And how he seems to love—"
"Well, then, have this washed, if possible," interrupted Dolly.
"Yes, ma'am. We have 2 women always specially kept for washing.